The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Our guest, Paul Hendrickson, has been a creative writing teacher at the University of Pennsylvania for more than 25 years. And before that, he was a feature writer at the Washington Post for two decades. He is the recipient of writing fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Lyndhurst Foundation, among other institutions. Paul's books include Sons of Mississippi, winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award, Hemingway's Boat, a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist, and Plagued by Fire, The Dreams and Furies of Frank Lloyd Wright. In his new book, Fighting the Night, described in the Wall Street Journal as a beautifully written and absorbing narrative, Hendrickson tells the story of his father's World War II service as a nighttime fighter pilot and the sacrifices he and his family and his generation made on behalf of their country. Tonight, Paul will be in conversation with Pulitzer Prize-nominated writer and journalist Will Haygood, author most recently of the critically acclaimed colorization, 100 Years of Black Films in a White World. Please welcome our guests back to the Free Library.
Hello, hello, Philadelphia. Thank you all for being here this evening to honor and celebrate Paul Hendrickson's new book, which has been getting stunning reviews. Before we get started, I wanted to say a little something right quick. Many years ago, I used to work in Charleston, West Virginia, when it was a blue state. And I was a copy editor. I worked at night 6 in the evening to midnight. In the newsroom, we would get other newspapers from around the country. So when I arrived in the newsroom, I always had a little downtime. I would go over to the little shelf where these newspapers were at, and I would read them. And one day, I came across a story in the Washington Post style section, and it was about one of my favorite writers, Langston Hughes. It was so beautifully written. Now, this was before email, way before email. It was so beautifully written that I said to myself, I've got to write this writer way over at the Washington Post and just say, man, that was a hell of a piece of writing, because it just knocked me out. I mean, I was a big Langston Hughes fan. And so I wrote him a handwritten letter to Paul Hendrickson, Washington Post, Washington, D.C., and told him what an impact that story had on me. Never expected to hear from the guy. He didn't know me from nobody. He didn't know, you know, if I was a, you know, somebody dreaming of becoming a writer one day. He didn't know if I was black or white. He didn't know where I was from. He didn't know what school I went to. Nothing. And he wrote back this beautiful letter, and he said, thank you for writing. I was so touched by your writing that I'd like to invite you to Washington, D.C. To visit me and my wife, Seal. And I said, well, you know, if I can come up with the money, I'll come, because I'll have to find a hotel. He said, no, you won't, stay with us. Just think of that. Just think of that space that he was in to invite an unknown, untested writer to come visit him. That was many years ago. And I'm very proud to say that the friendship has endured. And he's one of my literary heroes, so it is quite an honor to be here with Paul Hendrickson to celebrate his new wonderful book. So that said, let's get started.
But before you start reading what is on those cards, I'll just add on to that story. It's true. I think it was 1982. I think I can date it because it was about a year before my first book came out. And yes, I had written this feature story, which was assigned to me. And I heard from this guy in Charleston, West Virginia, and I kind of did something I hadn't done before or since. I think we did speak on the phone. And I said, well, why don't you just come on up here and visit us and stay with us. And that was all these years ago. I know it's warm in here. I'm already getting warmer just from that praise. And I don't want to turn this into a mutual admiration society, but Will is one of my literary heroes. I am just so pleased to be on this stage with you tonight. I don't think there is anyone in America who has more broadly or beautifully chronicled the Black experience, the African-American experience in America, than Will Haygood, with all of these biographies and cultural histories that he's done. He's lugging the paperback of his most recent book, even while he's working on his current book. So he just got some advanced copies of the paperback of his most recent book, which is a colorization about Black films in white America, the history of them. So, Will, yes, we better get started because we're boring our audience already. I will say thank you for coming out this evening, and very pleased to see some faces I recognize. Very pleased to see some members of my wife's family, and I'm very, very pleased to be here in the company of my wife, who always puts up with these books. You know, that's saying it euphemistically. We could spend the rest of the night talking about that. But I'm just honored to be here and honored to be a part of this series at the Free Library. Andy was just saying backstage that the podcasts have become such a large part of this author series. He said more important, almost more popular than the events themselves. And the lineup that they have every week is just astonishing. This is, I think, one of Philadelphia's jewels. This is one of the great cultural institutions for Philadelphia, and this author series is known across America. I personally know that because of other places I go to speak about my books, and they say, wow, the Free Library author series is really something. And I say, yes, I've been pleased to be a part of it a number of times. And sometimes I've been in the Will role, I think most recently, Andy, with David Marinus on this stage last year. So this is just a great thing Philadelphia has, in a great building and in a great room. And so, Will, ask away, sir.
Okay. Paul, by your nature, you are a searcher. You've often searched stories in this big, very complicated country of ours. Seminary, about your own experience as a youth in the seminary, the Vietnam War, Robert McNamara, Hemingway, White Sheriffs in Mississippi, Frank Lloyd Wright. Tell us, what were you searching for in Fighting the Night, the book about World War II and your father, Pilot?
That's such a great question and impossible to answer, but I'll make a stab at it. Yeah, search. I guess almost all of the books I have written in one way or another has been to try to go out and search for the truths that are somehow in my own heart. Never was that more true than in this book, and possibly in the first book I wrote, which is subtitled A Search. seminary:a search. It was searching for the meaning of the 7 years I spent in the 50s as a Catholic seminarian studying to be a priest. And everyone had left that life. It was an experience that couldn't survive the 60s. We all left. One guy of my original class became a priest, remained a priest. He's a priest today, but failing in ill health. I was just inquiring about him this week. That was a search to go out around the country and to try to see what kind of baggage from that intense religious experience did we bring with us into the secular world. I said somewhere in that book that everywhere I go, almost everything I do, the seminary comes clacking along behind like a child's duck dragged on a string. I think you could almost use that same metaphor for every book I've written. It's a search to try to understand in my own limited way, my own flawed way, a kernel of meaning for what this incredibly complicated country is about. I'll just say very quickly what this is about in a second, but I do want to say this. I forgot it in my little opening repartee to Will when I was saying he, more than he knows, is a literary hero of mine. I wrote a book called Sons of Mississippi. He just referenced it. It was more than 20 years ago. It was about civil rights in Mississippi, deriving itself entirely from one photograph. That book is dedicated to Will Haygood. And the dedication line reads, "For Will Haygood, who has shown me with his life." This book, I guess it's been, I say in the acknowledgments, it is a book that has simmered on the back of my eyeball for half a century. It's about a, in a sense, it's not even about World War II. Yes, my father piloted a P-61 Black Widow on Iwo Jima in the last 5.5 months of World War II. And there's plenty of war in the book, but in a sense, war is the secondary character. The first story, the predominant story, is a father, is a son searching for his father. My father was up there in his wild blue yonder. He was a hard man to try to understand and to feel in fleshy ways. There's a sad quote in the book, and it has been pointed out by several reviewers and interviewers. My dad said to me once, "All my problems begin when I get back down on the ground." I do believe, and it hurts me to say, that he was happiest up there in his wild blue yonder. We had a distant, sometimes distant, relationship, and yet there was something like so many sons in America or the world, I think sons in this audience, I have spent large parts of my life trying to reassemble the life of a man who both awed me and scared me for as long as I knew him. And that was almost 60 years. If my father could be difficult, there were so many heroic things too. Just to go to war as a boy, he was 25 years old. That's, you know, what was I doing at 25? I would not have been capable of doing what he did. And my mother included, who was 4.5 years younger, with 2 babies on her hip. She was 21 when he went off to war. One of those babies was me. These were the best years of their lives, like the old movie. So I think I was searching for that, Will. I was searching for the meaning of that. But it's a son's quest to know his father. You got many questions, and I'm talking too long. I'll just end this part with this strange, mysterious little fact that means everything to me. Today is Thursday the 16th. The book was published officially last week on Tuesday, May 7th. That's the day my father died. He died on May 7th, 2003. So the book was published on the 21st anniversary of his death, and I happen to know that the marketers chose that date, not the editorial team, and the marketers certainly didn't read the book. That's not their job. Their job is to sell the darn book. So I count myself inordinately lucky to have gotten this book done at all. On its most basic level, Will, I think it's a search to know someone, as I said, of whom I was both in awe of and in some sense scared of for as long as I knew him.
Paul, that really leads me to this question. I was 20 years old before I took my first airplane flight. You were much younger, and you were flying with your dad. I never lived with my dad. So the poignancy of that, of you up in the blue skies with your dad, can you take us through a day, the night before, getting ready to fly, knowing that your pop, your dad, was going to take you up in the sky, and then how you went on later in life and still had the confidence to go up into the air with your dad?
Will's questions are poetic, aren't they? My father was a flyer almost as long as I knew him. I mean, a flyer all my life, you could say. It's not technically true. But boy, it's almost true. He had a 30-year airline career after the war. He flew for Eastern Airlines. So deep into his 70s, when he was flying around the country in his own little private plane, he had to retire from the airlines at age 59 because he couldn't pass the physicals anymore. His heart had caught up with him. Nonetheless, he lived to be almost 85. And even though his heart had been failing him for decades, when he would come and visit us at our home in Maryland, suburban Maryland, I'm working for the Washington Post, I can remember him taking the steps two at a time when he was in the last two or three years of his life. He never let his belly go slack in the way of old aviators. He was one of the most fit men I ever knew right up until he died, but he had this failing heart. Well, deep into his 70s, in his little private plane flying around America, a Beechcraft Debonair, I would fly with him, and I was unafraid. I was unafraid to fly with my father deep into his 70s. I was in awe. I was in wonder at his skills. We once went to a fly-in in Ontario where the fishing lodge, he was meeting old pilots. The fishing lodge had its own grass landing strip. He forked that sucker in and on a grass strip and handed the landing strip back some change. he was 75 then. And every once in a while, you know, I can't fly a lick. There were five children in our family. Three are alive now. And my kid brother, Mark, who's 14 years younger, is the only aviator in the family. He followed my dad into his profession. I will see him next week. Seal and I will see him next week in Chicago when we're out there doing. Mark wanted to emulate his father. I wanted to emulate my father, but I was afraid to be a pilot. My dad used to say when we would go to these fly-ins and meet other pilots, he would say, "Never trust a damn writer. He's going to write it down. He's going to use it against you later. This is my son. He works for the Washington Post. Don't tell him a thing." But he was secretly proud. And I later came to realize, I think, that maybe our professions weren't that wildly different. We were both trying to navigate our way to something. Although his, of course, and not least in World War II over Iwo Jima, had always the lurk of explicit danger. Will, he would take me up in this little private plane, and you go through the ritual before you take off. He would hand me over a laminated card, and we would have this strange duet. It was like call and response. I knew my part of I would have to say engines, and he'd say mixture, rich, and we'd call back and forth because I had my responses on the card, and I better have them right. And then we would sail up, and we would be up for an hour. I was never scared to be with him. And every once in a while, he would turn the wheel over to me. All I had to do was try to hold it steady against the horizon, and he would give me an attaboy, Paul. Those attaboy Pauls were worth gold bullions. And every once in a while, he would lie his knobby farm boy Kentucky hand and arm on my knee. And that was an attaboy, Paul. So this was a man I was dying to know more. He 4 or 5 times only in his entire life, for all those years I knew him, did he ever speak about World War II. I tried to pull it out of him, but like all of those guys, they didn't want to talk about it. And now I'm haunted. I'm haunted by all I don't know. I've lost my chance. And this book was some way, in some sense, of trying to get that chance back.
Wow. Wow. Paul, what is it that Americans need from World War II? When I found out you were working on a book about World War II, I said to myself, there are thousands of books written about World War II, but I know Paul will go in a different window and come out with his own unique story. We just had Steven Spielberg produced miniseries, Masters of the Air. And why is it that World War II seems to keep climbing up on our backs even more than the Civil War itself? What is it that we need from World War II?
Again, these questions are beautiful and in a sense unanswerable, Will. I mean, it's the quality of this kind of idea that seems so rich that you really can't get any true answer. But maybe, you know, that way overused phrase, the greatest generation. Yes, they were the greatest generation. They were terribly flawed like all the rest of us. But World War II, I think, did represent a moment when everyone pulled together, and we've seemed to have lost that. World War II has a hold on us that even Vietnam, and I'm of the Vietnam generation, and parentheses, ladies and gentlemen, Will Haygood is writing a book right this moment about the black experience in Vietnam. I wrote a book about Vietnam myself. Vietnam has a terrible hold on us still. Terrible in the sense of powerful, great, awful. But World War II, the 1940s, this moment when these kids, millions and millions and millions of kids, were jerked out of their everyday mundane existence to do something far larger than themselves, way beyond themselves. These photographs in the book that I have of my father standing in front of the Rita B, that's the name of his plane, the P-61 Black Widow, she was called the Rita B because that was my mother's name, Rita Bernadine. And my dad is standing there on the tarmac, 8,000 miles out into the Pacific, He's 25 years old, and his wife Rita, with baby Paul and older brother Marty, are back in Xenia, Ohio, where it's the farm town where my mom is from, and they were waiting out the war with her parents, like tens of millions of other stories. I look at that photograph and those photographs in the book of my dad standing in front of his plane, and I get the sense that, yes, he's trying to choke down the fear with every mission. I'm sure of it. But I think he also has some sense that he's participating in something way, way beyond himself and way beyond his years. He's in him. He knows he's an actor in his own moment of history. And maybe it will never get more powerful than this.
Paul, I have long wanted to ask you this following question. Poems seem to always find a place in your work, whether you're writing about death, dying, blood, youth, beauty. Poems always seem to find a place in your work when you yourself have a very poetic voice. Why are these poems important to you? And how do you know when you've found just the right poem to express a certain sentiment?
I love the questions, Will. I do read a lot of poetry. I cannot be a poet, but I can love the poetry, and I go to bed late at night reading poetry, and my wife rolls her eyes and say, oh, no, not another moody Irish poet he's reading. Oh, no. A great bombardier poet in World War II, Richard Hugo. Will and I know Richard Hugo. He's long been dead. He was a bombardier on a B-24 Liberator. He has a line... choking down the powdered eggs at midnight, and the line is, always the phlegm before the engines warmed. My dad was a sharecropper's son in western Kentucky, one of nine children. He grew up in the 1930s watching crop dusters fly overhead. He terribly wanted to fly, and he had never gotten out of the county he was born in until he was 18 years old and enlisted in the Army Air Corps in 1937, 4 years before the war began. My grandmother, his mother said, Joe Paul, because they all have double names in Kentucky, Joe Paul, if you want to commit suicide, why don't you just go out there and jump off the barn? But... a significant part of this book is about growing up in Kentucky and this leap, which is the only way I can think of it. It's a leap through space and time that my father made from a sharecropper's son in know-nothing rural Kentucky, where there was no indoor plumbing and there was no electricity. There's a long chapter called Long Ago in Kentucky. It's an early chapter in the book. And I start the whole book with an epigraph from Robert Penn Warren's poem, Tell Me a Story. Can I read just a few lines? Long ago in Kentucky, I, a boy, stood by a dirt road in first dark and heard the great geese hoot northward. I could not see them, there being no moon, and the stars sparse. I heard them. I did not know what was happening in my heart. Tell me a story. In this century and moment of mania, tell me a story. Make it a story of great distances and starlight. Yes, I tried to tell in this book a story of great distances and starlight, something like 8,000 miles out into the Pacific. I wonder, I'm not trying to steal the time here with poetry, but I end, that's at the start, at the very end of the book in the epilogue. Well, no. I mean, that poem is great too, but how about this poem? and then How about this poem? And this poem will speak to Will. There is a great, great African-American poet, Robert Hayden. And you know his poetry, Will,
yes.
Right? And
yes.
Why can't I find it now? I'm killing our time. But so long ago in Kentucky, tell me a story of great distances and starlight. If this is a book about a son's quest to try to know his father, and there's some negative baggage to be euphemistic about it, there is also what's embedded in this poem that's what I'm trying to say about my father. The decency. Yes, he could be violent. He could be stern. He could be uncommunicative. But there was something also that he was showing me about living up to your obligations, honoring your obligations, doing your duty. Never more so, by the way, than when he was dying and he accepted what the doctor told him and we were in the room. But listen to this. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. And then with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I don't know. Maybe in this book, I'm trying to thank him for those banked fires, metaphorically at least, that he blazed through all my childhood.
That, ladies and gentlemen, from a man who is a poet in his heart. Paul, you rather famously started a certain book project, got lost in it, and abandoned it, went off and wrote another book, then came back to that original book, and I'd be damned if both of the books didn't win major literary prizes. So I'm sure if there are any writers here, and there are notable writers here, the great Loreen Carey is here. I'm sure writers here would like to know the lessons learned from such an experience.
Do you know Will and I were just in the back in the green room, and we were talking, in a certain sense, about the exact question that he's raising. Writing is the most difficult thing I know, other than trying to be a good husband and a good father. I tell my writing students, it's like trying to read Braille on the cave wall of your mind. Will and I know each other's history so well. He's referencing a book. It was the book about Vietnam called The Living and the Dead. And it ended up, 12 years after it began, with another book in between. It did end up as a finalist for the National Book Award. But I had to give up that book and crawl back to the Washington Post, ask my editors at the Washington Post if I could have my old job back. I was so shaken as a writer. I didn't know if I could even write dumb little four-paragraph newspaper stories anymore. I did start to reclaim our broken family finances, never mind that Seal was always holding the fort down, being a mother and her own job and our health care, et cetera. But I did go back to the Washington Post and then wrote another book in between about a great documentary photographer of the 1930s. That book came about because her name is Marion Post Wolcott, and she took amazing black and white photographs from the Depression of the 1930s. And the story of her life was that she had given up. She had stopped shooting because she got into a complicated marital situation. And I thought, wait a minute, how do you just stop something if you are so gifted at it? And so I began to search her out. And I spent the last 3 years going to Santa Barbara, California, to interview Marion Post Wolcott. And the central thing she taught me, which I think saved more than my writing life, I think, In some ways, it saved my literal life. The central thing she taught me was that you can make your survival a grace, not just a grim necessity. So I got that book written. It's called Looking for the Light. That's a search, isn't it? Looking for the Light, The Hidden Life and Art of Marian Post Wolcott. After that book was published, I had the kind of wherewithal, with the support of my wife, with the support of my family, with my editor nudging me forward, to try to remount the McNamara book. And I did. And when that book was published, and we had a big book event in Washington, D.C., I asked my two sons to come to the front of the room. That book started in 1984 and was published in 1996. In 1984, when I began it, well, we only had one son. In 1996, when that book was published, Matt, our older son, was 12, and John was 8. I asked them to come to the front of the room, and I said, people have asked me how long this struggle has gone on. It's gone on about this long and about this long. And I got a line of applause from that. History repeats itself. So when we had this book event last week at Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C., I asked my two grandsons, to whom fighting the night is dedicated, I asked Jackson, 8, and Teddy, 4, to come to the front of the room. And, of course, they walked away with the show. Anything we said after that for the next 50 minutes could have been gibberish, because those two kids stole the show. It's on YouTube, by the way. So history does repeat itself. But you know, what Will and I were talking about backstage, and please, ladies and gentlemen, I do not mean this to sound in any sense like a humble brag or in any sense puffed up. Writing is, Will, I asked Will when we picked him at the train station, did you get any work done today? He said, yes. Will was in the writing seat, the cockpit seat this morning, before he got on that train to come to Philadelphia. It's 98% perspiration and 2% inspiration. You know what it is? It's seat of the pants to the seat of the chair. It's going in there 6 days a week and staring down your doubt and your fear.
Amen. We have time for one more question, and Paul, here is the final question, and actually a form of a tribute to your mother and father, who must have danced to Cole Porter or Duke Ellington. Mm-hmm. Or Sinatra.
Ella Fitzgerald.
Or Ella Fitzgerald. We live in an age, Paul, where facts are being attacked. Mm. Books are being banned. And it seems to me that what you do is God's work. What in this environment keeps you going, and what do you tell your students to keep them inspired and to keep them believing in the richness in the scope of deeply reported, deeply researched nonfiction books which you have spent your life giving us?
Back at you, Mr. Will. Back at you. It's what you do. Will is a decade younger than I am. We invited him up to our home that long ago time, 1982 in Washington. Will has written more books than I have. He's relentless. I'm not answering the question directly, but can I tell you this? I got a letter, and when I say letter, I mean email, from someone who has been reading my books since 1983, when my seminary search was published the year after I met the great Will Haygood from the copy desk of the Charleston Gazette. Man, has he come a long way. He went to Pittsburgh, Boston, Washington Post, and he's here tonight with all these books in his beautiful wake. This guy lives in Tyler, Texas. We've never met. He wrote me the most beautiful email last week. He read the book in 24 hours, he said, and he got up at 4 a.m. to finish it. Writers, it is hot in here, and I'm probably falling into my senescence, so I should try to succinctly say what I'm trying to say. Writers, Will would so second this, depend crucially on you out there in the audience tonight. We depend so crucially on our readers. I've told my students that a book, a piece of writing is what they do. It's dead when it leaves the writer's hands and it begins to breathe. It begins to live again when it's in the reader's hands. This guy, his name is Lynn McClellan. He lives in Tyler, Texas. We've never met. He wrote me this heart email a few days ago after having read the book practically nonstop last week. And he said, Paul, I think what I'm about to say is very thematic to what I have been trying in roundabout ways to say what this book wants to be. He said, Paul, in the 80s, I remember reading a novel by the great Peter Taylor. I don't know if that name has any resonance. Peter Taylor was a mid-20th century novelist. He is somewhat forgotten now. He was a Southerner, and he wrote a beautiful novel, prize-winning novel, I think a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, called A Summons to Memphis. And Lynn McClellan said to me in this email last week, speaking of this book, he said, I have forgotten everything about that novel, except how deeply it touched me at the time. He said, but Paul, I do remember this sentence. We have to forgive our parents. In some way, I think this is a book about trying to forgive my parents for innocent and blundering, and sometimes not innocent and sometimes not blundering, mistakes that they made. There is no manual for being a parent. In the same way that I hope many years from now, when I certainly won't be on the earth, that my two sons will be able to say that I can forgive you, Dad, for all of your innocent blunderings and flaws and mistakes, and sometimes not so innocent blunderings and mistakes and flaws. That's all this book is trying to be.
Ladies and gentlemen, we read books because of the likes of Paul Hendrickson, still fighting the good fight, and now the author of Fighting the Night. That ends this portion of the program, but we're going to open it up. I'm going to open it up for your questions to Paul.
Thank you both so much. Really impactful. My question is, you mentioned being awed and afraid of your father, and I was wondering what role your mother, Rita B., may have played in that relationship or that dynamic.
A whole other book could and should be written about my mom. Like millions of moms, she shouldered all of the burdens of staying stateside. She must have been getting on her knees every night and praying that she wouldn't become a widow at age 21. You know, when you're a flyer and then you come home and become an airline pilot and then work your way up to becoming a captain, this leap through time and space that he made, he was a sharecropper's son watching crop dusters go over, and he ended up flying the largest jets in the air that Eastern Airlines had out of O'Hare and Midway, to those intense airports in Chicago. His entire career was spent there. He would fly to Puerto Rico and back in the same day. But when you're a captain, maybe this answers your question. I can almost never remember getting in the car with my mother and father and the kids in the back seat when my mother drove. The captain was the captain, down on the ground and up there. And that's hard to live with. That's extremely hard to live with. And my mother, who had a very strong will, they were married for 61 years, and I cannot sit here tonight and tell you it was a peaceful union. It was a largely sorrowful union. They were very Catholic. There was no possibility they could get divorced or even separated. But that's not to say that they did not have their moments of tenderness, of extreme loyalty to each other. And when we would witness that, when we would witness all of the other, I see now that my mother, who developed some severe problems in life, some drinking problems. I mean, so much of this is contextual to my father's, you know, his very large and I'll use the word severe role in the family. But my mother, my goodness, she was so involved in our lives. I think last week I said this just came out of my mouth. I said something like, the father is the eagle, but the mother owns the heart. That was so true in our family. The mother owned the heart. My mom would iron a shirt at midnight in the basement for us when we were in eighth grade. My father didn't know where the iron was. You can imagine it was difficult for her to find her place. But I do not want to leave this night, in which I don't know. I have found myself talking kind of maybe more emotionally than I expected to talk, with the idea that it was a large 6 decades of unhappiness. That's not true, but it was difficult. It was difficult. And a whole other book. My mom, when Will was reading some of the early portions of this book, when it was appearing several places in Literary Hub, and which is an online magazine, Will was very taken, I remember, writing me emails about, wow, your mother, wow, there's a powerful war wife. I mean, they said goodbye to each other in a parking lot of a dusty motel in Amarillo, Texas. And they, you know, he's 25, she's 21. They have no idea if they'll ever see each other again. And she made her way on those wartime roads, driving 35 miles an hour with two little babies. And there was no such thing as disposable diapers. The poop is flying everywhere, the bottles. She, you know, made her way to 11 states away to her parents. My mother, the best years of their lives, the best years of my father's lives. And my father came home haunted from the war. He had PTSD. Who had a name for that? Who had a name for that then? And it took him 10 years to exorcise his PTSD. And I have to say that in some ways he took it out. He didn't have any other way of trying to escape it than by taking it out savagely on his son's backs with his belt sometimes. That's difficult to say to this audience. And my mother... My mother was there and witnessed that. And that's a difficult thing that I have to write about in the book. I'm sure I didn't answer your question satisfactorily. Is there another question? Oh, my beautiful old student from last year. Hey man.
Hey, Prof. I'm looking at the cover, and it's a beautiful photograph. And I was just wondering if you could talk about why this photograph for the cover, because I'm sure you have hundreds of pictures of your dad in wartime or at home, and just if you could talk about it a little bit, thank you.
It's a beautiful question. He was such a great student last year. We had such a good time. Thinking working for Comcast now here in the city. Thank you for coming. Was in a course called Telling Stories Out of Photographs. We really read photographs. We read photographs like we try to read a painting. There's my father looking back Is he going up tonight? This picture is in the daytime. Is he going up tonight? I don't know. There's no date on the back of the photo. But he's looking back, and he's got a half smile. There's something cocky there, but I think there's something aware of this incredible thing he's involved in. There's a confidence there, but man, he is so boyish there. I don't know. It just seems representative of who he was. I love the way he's looking back. Take this picture to whomever was snapping it from maybe the public information wing of his squadron, the 549th Night Fighter Squad. But our family, the three children who are left, we share these pictures. These pictures are such treasures to us. They're spread throughout the book. We have no letters. My mom wrote to my dad every day. He was overseas for 5.5 months. And he wrote back to her 2 or 3 times a week, he said, "Where are those letters? They're gone. We don't have them, but we have these photographs. And we have so much of the archival information I was able to dig up. And we have the little snippets of talk and conversation I was able to get out of my father. And we have the incredible notes I took like a scribbling madman when I went to a night fighter convention with him in 1982. And he's introducing me to his old flying cronies who all had crazy nicknames. Geronimo was one. And he's saying, "This is my son. He's a writer. He's tagging along. Never trust him. Don't tell him anything." But he was, I think my dad was secretly hoping that I would one day write this book, even if he didn't want me to write it. It's all, like your own parents, the story is very complicated. That's a great question. I don't know. We had so many photographs to choose, and I loved that one.
Hi, Professor Hendrickson. How are you?
How are you?
Good.
Good
Thank
to
you
see
so
you
much.
Again, too.
Good to see you, too. I was wondering, before you started this project, was there anything that was holding you back or something you were hesitant about before you started this search and discovery?
And I'll make it quick. These long answers. There were 500 things that were scaring me. We used to have a saying at the Washington Post, "In for a dime, in for a dollar." If you're going to go there, you better try to go all the way. So in this heat tonight, I tried to be in for a dime and in for a dollar. I tried to go all the way. But I was so scared. Here's something almost mystical, though. You would think if any book would be tailor-made for getting blocked, for scaring the hell out of you, that you would get not able to write it. When I sat down to write this book, after it hanging on the back of my eyeball for half a century, the words began to come easier than I really thought they would. But I had to stare down so many ghosts. And, you know, I really will end with this. Reviewers and elsewhere and comments. I wrote a long adaptation of this a year ago on Father's Day. And the comments, 500 of them or something, 585 of them, were overwhelmingly positive. But there were those in there that were saying, "A man who takes off his belt and beats his children, forget it. I don't need to read that book." I'm saying to you, this is not a book about whippings. It is not about that at all. But if you're going to go there, you have to go there. And the pain has to be told with the glory. And I hope that the pain is played in a minor key. And the major key is this heroic thing my parents did together when they were way too young. This thing that was asked of them, that your question, could we ever do something like this again as a nation? I wonder. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Paul Hendrickson.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.